Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
We're going to jump on some breaking news here in the state this afternoon. A federal court ruling striking down Wisconsin's voter ID rule. We're going to get the details in just a minute from our very own Sean Johnson.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think about the ruling? Join us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We want to hear what you think about the idea of voter ID laws. Supporters say we need it to help prevent fraud. Opponents say, hey, this is stifling voter turnout, discouraging people from voting at the polls. 800-642-1234 is the number. 800-642-1234. And we'll pop something up there on the Central Time Facebook page where you can put your comments. With us, we have Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio's state government reporter. Sean, thanks for joining us on shorter notice than usual.
Yeah, you bet. No problem.
So give us the basics here. What was the ruling?
The ruling essentially put the law, which was already on hold, enjoined it in federal court. Judge Lynn Edelman wrote that it violates the U.S. Constitution and the Federal Voting Rights Act, because it would deter a substantial number of eligible voters from casting a ballot. And he wrote that the conclusion that blacks and Latinos disproportionately lack IDs is inescapable. So he's saying that, especially his decision addressed that second point in great detail, that the law as it's written will disproportionately hurt blacks and Latinos and keep them from casting a ballot. And so the law, you know, which has not really been in effect in Wisconsin, is now enjoined in federal court.
And how is this ruling going over in Wisconsin so far? Do we know a reaction?
Well, I mean, we knew that there was a possibility that a court, either a federal court or the state Supreme Court, was going to rule that Wisconsin's voter ID law is unconstitutional. And Republican leaders, including the governor, had already raised the prospect of calling a special session of the legislature once that happens. They're kind of backing away from that today, and I think partly because of the way that Judge Edelman wrote his decision. You know, he said, "I'm aware that there, you know, the legislature might amend the photo ID law, and that if they do that, you know, they could move to have relief from the permanent injunction. You know, essentially lift the injunction, have the law back in effect." And if they do that close to an election, I will hold, you know, hearings in an expedited fashion. But he said, you know, quote, given the evidence presented at trial showing that blacks and Latinos are more likely than whites to lack an ID, it is difficult to see how an amendment to the photo ID requirement could remove its disproportionate racial impact and discriminatory results. So there's Judge Edelman essentially telling the legislature, look, you can amend this if you want. I don't see how you're going to get around this concern.
Quick reminder, we're inviting you to join in with your reactions to this ruling on the state's voter ID law, effectively putting the kibosh on it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sean, this ruling really went further than I think a lot of people expected, including, as you were saying, members of the legislature who thought a tweak here, a tweak there, even if it's struck down, it'll pass muster. The judge saying, as if it comes back to me, there's probably not a change that's going to make me change my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty strong language there for a judge to say that, you know, to kind of acknowledge the political realities that the legislature is considering changing this and to kind of send them a message. So at this point, what you have is the governor, the attorney general, the majority leader in the state Senate and the speaker of the state assembly are all going to get together, and they're going to decide what makes sense in terms of how to proceed. And the attorney general has already said he wants to appeal. If they appeal, it goes to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And, you know, Republicans like their chances there because the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld other voter ID laws. But people who are challenging this law say, first of all, the law is different. Second of all, you know, they're challenging it on using a different challenge in the Voting Rights Act than has been successful before. And so, you know, they like their chances there, too.
So with this appeal of J.B. Van Hollen, what are the next steps? And can you give us a sense of the timeline as to how that could unfold, certainly as regards the fall election?
Well, I mean, the timeline, especially to those of us who don't work in the legal profession, I you know, it moves slowly. These appeals move slowly. And so I just, you know, as you ask me here today, it's hard to imagine this all being resolved before the November election. Remember, you also have two other cases challenging the voter ID law before the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court has yet to act on those cases. And, you know, the state Supreme Court, which has a what most people consider to be a conservative majority, justices during oral arguments indicated that they have some issues with it. And the thinking is that the state Supreme Court will probably find some problem with the voter ID law. And so then you've got to address those concerns, too.
Well, we'll get to our callers in just a moment, Sean. But is the state Supreme Court's decision views on this moot now, given what we've heard from the federal court?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, any voter ID law, if they want to have voter ID law in Wisconsin, would have to be constitutional under the U.S. and state constitutions, and so these are different challenges. Judge Adelman today found that it violated the U.S. Constitution and the Federal Voting Rights Act. The challenges for the state Supreme Court are challenges under the state constitution. So I'm not sure that it's moot, but definitely viewed through a different lens now, because it's not a case where they can just come back, you know, maybe address something that they knew was coming from the state Supreme Court and, you know, have it in place before the November election. If they're going to pursue a federal appeal, which is it would appear they are, you know, that suddenly you're fighting on a few different fronts.
WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson stays with us as we talk about today's ruling striking down the voter ID law here in Wisconsin. That's in a federal court. And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Bob starting us off in Grafton. Bob, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think Judge Adelman's decision was extremely good. I was down. I'm a major supporter of the League of Women Voters suit, and I was down there in the Supreme Court when it appeared that many of the conservative justices were very, very uncomfortable about the burdens that were put on all people, not just blacks and Hispanics. This is really, in my opinion, as a white Protestant business person, conservative, really a way designed to suppress votes. And I'm glad to see that Adelman really did something about it.
Bob, thanks for your call. Sean, you alluded to this. Did you read the conservative justices on the state Supreme Court similarly to the way Bob was suggesting they were reacting?
Yeah, I mean, you can get in trouble by trying to read what justices say during oral arguments, because sometimes they're trying to be the devil's advocate. They're trying to be a skeptic to make sure they get all the information they want. You know, that said, I think most people listened to Justice Patience Rogensack during those oral arguments and thought, there's somebody who has problems with this law. And, you know, it's a small world state government, and so rumors kind of travel fast, especially when, you know, all the state government is run by Republicans, and they're not out there saying, yeah, we think we got this one in the bag. They've been out there talking about, we think probably some changes are necessary, and so we're prepared to come back and take care of those. So I think the read of Justice Rogensack and of the state Supreme Court, you know, my read is that it's probably a good read at this point.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Bob. And we'll go next to Pat in Brookfield. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I think here's what we need to do. Let's get rid of the whole voter ID thing. I just walked out of a company called Suntan City on Grandview Boulevard in Waukesha. And you know what I had to do? I had to take my index finger, press four times on this little machine in order to get my key card. So they told me that other people can't use my name to get tanning in these franchises throughout the country. There's got to be some kind of way, whether it's too hard or not, to get a free ID or whatever. I mean, we look in Afghanistan, these third world countries, and they're holding up their index finger where they had to give a fingerprint. So let's forget about all the ID cards. Let's go ahead and get some type of scanning machine or some type of fingerprinting like these third world countries do, to where we just know it's one vote for one person. All right.
Thanks a lot for the thought, Pat. And Sean, I don't know, a tech solution down the road rendering all this moot, or maybe that could be at issue too.
I guess you got to do what you can to prevent tanning fraud. I don't see Republicans backing away from voter ID, you know, in the near future. They're going to be talking about how it's something that the public supports. They view it as a common sense solution, and so they're going to keep pushing for it. And you know, Democrats are—it's going to be a familiar refrain. They're going to be saying this is a solution in search of a problem that we don't have evidence of, you know, voter impersonation fraud that warrants this.
Taking your calls on voter ID and today's federal court ruling striking down Wisconsin's law at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to the phones in just a moment, Sean, but is this a thing that's been watched in other states, or is what happens here in Wisconsin going to have a domino effect elsewhere in the country, do you think?
There's voter ID laws all over the country, and so, you know, it's just too early for me to say with confidence what Wisconsin's ruling is going to mean in other states. I think for it to have an effect in other states, you would have to see, you know, the appeals court side with Judge Adelman, and then it would, if they did, I think you would ultimately see it appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and, you know, then we're talking. At this point, it's one federal judge's ruling. It's very significant in Wisconsin, but I'm not sure it's going to create ripple effects just yet.
Okay, and we'll go back to the phones now. Nick is joining us in Greenfield. Hey, Nick.
Yeah, thank you. If people have really been paying attention, this is part of a nationwide effort to curtail voting by one segment of the citizens that usually support the Democrats. So the whole point of this is to try and stifle, well, say if they can stifle even 1% of the voters who may vote for the other side, that will give the Republicans, who are the people who are pushing for this, an unfair advantage. And one other thing is that, you know, if they were saying that this was a problem, it's been proven pretty much nationwide that it's not a problem.
All right. Thanks for that call, Nick. We'll go straight to Scott now in Nisida. Scott, hi.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm sorry that I just don't understand why this is a problem for Black and Latino voters. To me, it seems like, well, okay, if it's a problem for voting, why isn't it a problem for driving a car? It's like, well, it's like, so we say, oh, we can't have driver's license with their IDs on it because then it would prevent Black and Latinos from driving cars. It's like, well, okay, what's the hurdle here? I don't get it.
Scott, thanks for the call. Sean, Scott, and Nick presenting a couple common arguments on both sides of this. This federal court ruling not going to end the political debate on this issue, is it?
Oh, no. No, I mean, I expect you'll hear points like those, especially if we ultimately do have this back in the legislative arena at some point. You will hear those points made again. You know, as far as the number of places where you have to have an ID, where it's just accepted, the video store, driving a car, that's a point that's often made by Republicans. The point that's you know, made to refute that is that voting's a different you know, different thing altogether, and that you have to basically have a higher burden. I mean, it's just more important constitutionally, you know, that you are able to vote than it is that you are able to drive a car. And then, you know, as far as what this would do for turnout, we haven't really seen in Wisconsin yet what it would do for turnout because it hadn't been in place. I mean, it was in place for one very low turnout election in 2012 before two circuit courts, state courts, you know, locked it up. And that's where it's been ever since.
And we'll leave it there. Sean, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in two cases today that could have serious implications for digital privacy down the road.
The court will try and determine whether or not police, after placing someone at arrest, can examine the full contents of the arrestee's cell phone without first obtaining a search warrant.
Joining us now to give us some background on the cases and what's at stake, we have Dustin Voles, staff correspondent for the National Journal, where he covers technology policy. Dustin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
We've got two cases, variations on a theme. Let's briefly sort out what each of them does. Riley versus California was one of the two.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court heard two cases this morning, and Riley v. California was the first one, although it is actually dealing with more modern technology. It's a 2009 case involving a San Diego man who had his smartphone searched twice, once at the scene of arrest and then again later at the police precinct. This was done without a warrant. And the other case actually is from 2007 out of Boston, dealing with a suspected drug dealer there. And that phone, that case deals with a flip phone, which is more or less obsolete these days, I think. But that's really kind of the main difference between the two cases. Fundamentally, they're dealing with the same question, which is, can police warrantlessly during an arrest grab someone's cell phone and look through the contents of it before, you know, they go to a court and get a warrant for it.
What's the current state of the art in the law?
Currently, the phone is I mean, states do have laws on the books that differ slightly, but by and large, most times police are allowed to, if you have something on your person, you know, that's something in your pocket, police are allowed to take it and examine it. This is kind of called the from incident to arrest standard, that they can do this because there's a fear that, you know, a suspect could destroy evidence that's within his reach, or they could do something that could potentially endanger the safety of officers, and, you know, something like a firearm. So decades of jurisprudence has allowed police to seize and search anything that can be within reach of a suspect. And this is probably most commonly or most well-known is applied to a car. You know, police, if they're arresting someone, they oftentimes can search the contents of a car if they have reason to believe that there's something there that might be of significance.
So all the stuff I've got on hand when I'm arrested is fair game for the police without a warrant. But now we have these phones that are, you know, as powerful as, more powerful even maybe than a personal computer was 10 years ago. Is that the idea behind challenges to this view of the law?
Right. I mean, that was certainly the crux of the debate during Riley v. California, though the first case that was heard. This idea that, you know, our phones today are hold so much data. They have, you know, thousands of photos if we want. They have a bunch of applications. They have text messages, calls, GPS information, banking information, medical records. That is an enormous amount of personal information. You're essentially, you know, with your cell phone, you're walking around with all of the data of your entire life, you know, maybe even your social security number in your phone. And privacy advocates are really worried that this is kind of opening the door to, you know, unfair search of people's private lives. The Fourth Amendment standard that protects against unreasonable search and seizures, you know, that goes back to the Constitution, obviously, and all of these standards predate cell phones. And the logic there is that, you know, when you say that police can seize the personal affects of a suspect, never before was anyone able to carry this much data on them. You know, if in a book or you know, a few photos in your wallet, that's insignificant compared to what we now have on our phones.
And so critics are saying they're raising a constitutional challenge in effect here, saying without a warrant you're accessing way more data than you should be able to access.
Yeah, and that was a point that came up during the debate. Justice Elena Kagan, one of the liberal justices, actually noted that, you know, police can arrest someone for driving without a seatbelt, you know, which most arrests that do occur are for, you know, pretty petty crimes. But police can arrest someone for something like that and then, you know, proceed to then look through their entire, all the personal contents of their cell phone. And you know, she seemed really concerned, and as did a number of other justices, that's just not really, that's not consistent, that police shouldn't be able to open up this treasure trove of data for most crimes. But at the same time, they also did articulate a need for, in certain cases, that there are times when a phone needs to be looked at, especially if it's involving a violent crime, or maybe a terrorist plot. And so as often is the case with courts, and especially the Supreme Court, they did seem to be wanting to look for a nuanced ruling. I don't think there's going to be a categorical ruling one way or the other that either always allows warrantless searches of phones or never allows them. But exactly where they're going to draw that line, I think, is anyone's guess. And we all know the Supreme Court is notoriously difficult to predict.
What's the argument from the police side or the state or the federal law enforcement on their side saying, yeah, we need ready access to a smartphone of somebody we arrest?
So state prosecutors in both Massachusetts and California, where these cases come from, as well as the Justice Department, which also argued today, they say that police they need to be able to look at cell phones to do their jobs and to protect themselves and procure necessary evidence.
And to do it quickly, right?
There's kind of this issue of that's all well and good, but why can't you just wait for a warrant? Their claim is that today's world, phones can remotely be accessed by nefarious bad actors who would want to either blow it up through some means, or probably more likely wipe what could be crucial important information that would maybe lead to a criminal conviction. And so if you wait to get a warrant, you might lose your window of opportunity to see that data. So
my favorite lingo from this argument is the Faraday cage. Evidently, there's a way supposedly for police to take this phone, put it in a device, and protect it from that kind of outside contact deleting data.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, you've done your research. The Faraday case kind of came up a few times during the 2 hours of hearings. It's this notion that you put a phone in this kind of box where no signal can get through, and then you effectively disable it. But as one of the justices noted, and also one of the lawyers, that to take that out of the box, you would then presumably allow the phone to then be accessible. And they discussed how in one of the – some police force actually tried to build an entire Faraday room where you could go into the room with the phone and look at it. But it was too big, and they said that the Verizon signal actually was able to bust through. So there were a lot of different novel ideas thrown out. One of them by Justice Sotomayor was to kind of just to tell officers to immediately turn phones on airplane mode to prevent people from remotely accessing it so they wouldn't be able to delete data. There were a lot of different ideas thrown out, but none of them, I think, were really a clear definitive solution. And so it's anyone's guess exactly where the Supreme Court's going to draw a line on this.
Science fiction meets jurisprudence. Dustin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
We've been talking with Dustin Voles. He's staff correspondent for the National Journal, where he covers technology policy.